Welcome to the Channel Masters Prerequisite Webinar. We're going to take a few minutes here to be sure that we have common understanding of terminology, business models, and most importantly, financials. So I just want to start out by thanking you for taking time to join us. And for those of you I haven't met, my name is Raulene Oakes. I'm a former channel chief at IBM, BEA, and Oracle, who joined the IPED Consulting Group, I don't know, maybe 8 years or so ago. And I will be working with you along with my colleague, Mark Williams, when we meet in person for the Channel Masters kickoff. But today I'm going to spend just a few minutes with you to go through some of the prerequisites. Now, just one more side note before we get started. For those of you who may know some of the brands at the Channel Company, but maybe not all, thought I'd take a minute just to walk you through. Most folks know the CRN brand or CRN magazine because so many of you advertise with us and many of our subscribers, in fact, come from our database. But you may also know the Exchange brand, the Exchange conferences, Best of Breed, Women of the Channel. All of those come under the Exchange conference brand. And then Mark and I are part of the IPED Consulting Group. We are the consulting, research, and education arm of the Channel Company. And then there is one more group. That's the Partner Demand Services. That is the partner marketing arm that we operate on behalf of many of you in terms of using MDF to get out and help partners build pipeline. All four of the Channel Company brands do leverage one of our big differentiators, which is the Channel Company database. And you see here on the right-hand side, this roughly holds about 1.5 million partner contacts that represent roughly 150 to 160,000 solution provider businesses across the U.S. So one of our differentiators. I will say, specific to IPED Consulting, another differentiator is every consultant that you'll have contact with, whether it's Mark or Beth, myself, Dominic, John, whomever, all of us have been in your seat at one point in time and another in our careers, meaning whether we were channel chiefs, managers, vice presidents in distribution, whatever the case might be, all of us came from the channel and then chose to come over to on the consulting, education, and research side. We do not hire professional consultants that have not had hands-on or operational experience. Okay? So that's just a little bit to get started in terms of introductions, not only of myself, but also of the Channel Company. And now what I'd like to do is introduce the topics that we're going to spend time on today. And there are three main topics. Number one, we'll start out with partner business models. From there, we'll take a look at cloud and managed services and the impact of cloud managed services to these business models. And then we'll close out on the third topic, which is how partners make money or partner profitability. And we're just big believers that when you understand what partners do, meaning their business models, and how they make money, you can better build and deploy partner programs that help the partners make money, which then bring them back to you in terms of more business, higher loyalty, greater levels of engagement. And that's why we take the time from a prerequisite perspective to be sure that we're all using the same terminology and we all have the same understanding of, let's say, a P&L or a profit and loss statement. Okay? So those are our agendas. Now, what you saw on the previous slide was a pie chart of business models that roughly represents the partner population in the U.S. But before we even go through that, because we're going to go through that in great detail, I want to start out by saying there is no such thing as a partner who plays in one business model, meaning there are no pure play partners anymore. And let me tell you exactly what that means. 20 years ago, there were VARs, value-added resellers, who today we call solution providers, so VAR or solution providers. But 20 years ago, that's what they did. 100% of their company revenues were recognized by reselling product, hardware and software, and maybe some maintenance service. Today, we'll show you that those partners typically do not exist. And so what I'd like to introduce to you here on this slide is the way we build through puzzle pieces the types of business models that are actually operating in your partner ecosystems today. And we've outlined three. One is the hybrid VAR, and what you can see is that partner is made up of 70% of his company revenues, roughly, come from value-added reselling, and maybe another 30% come from managed services. Okay, 70% reselling, 30% managed services, and that kind of looks like a typical VAR today. We see quite a bit of these, and we tend to call them our hybrid VAR. The next model down would be a managed service provider, and we picked one flavor of managed service providers. To get all the flavors, you'd have to look at our managed service provider playbook, and we have lots of detail on this. But a managed service provider could be 50, 60, 70% managed services and maybe 30% reselling. And typically, a managed service provider would resell to accommodate a customer's need when a customer needs some on-premise equipment, even though the managed service provider is in the business of providing managed services. So there's an accommodation piece sometimes that plays there. And the third example would be a partner who is roughly 70% consulting services, and then 30%, it could be reselling to accommodate a customer's need. It could be new managed services like managed security or managed networking to complement the consulting IT, let's say, services that he's delivering. But these are three examples of how you would take those business models that were on the previous pie chart, and you actually have to put them together in puzzle pieces to reflect a primary business model, which would be the 70% in these cases, and a secondary business model, typically represented by the 30% puzzle pieces, that really show you what partners actually look like today. Okay, so primary and secondary business model. Now, the deal is ultimately, and we could do a whole discussion on how you use these models. We would tell you that it's in your best interest as people who impact partner programs to truly understand and dissect your true partner profiles, meaning the profile of partners in your ecosystems. Understand which roles they play, and typically it's multiple roles. You might take a look at your partner ecosystem, and it could be largely made up of VARs, MSPs, and consultants. Those are three pure play roles. But you might also be a vendor whose, partner ecosystem is made up of ISVs and developers and telephony agents. So it really depends. You have to put these puzzle pieces together. We would then tell you, once you've identified the primary business model and maybe the secondary business model, you have to decide roughly what are the right percentages. Are they 50-50, 70-30, 60-40, whatever the case, but typically unique to your partners, and you don't have to do it for every partner. You're doing it generally as a whole in terms of representing the best you can the partner community you support. And once you do that, and it gives you one of these hybrid business models, like a systems integrator or a managed service provider or a hybrid VAR, you can then take that and benchmark your program against what other programs are doing. And you would tend to take a look at one of our studies. We have a profitability study, and the profitability study would tell you exactly, based on these hybrid business models, what the partners value. Okay, so once you understand the business models, which tend to represent their roles, right, VARs, resell, managed services providers, manage, consultants, provide pre-sales and post-sales consulting, once you understand the roles that they are delivering, you can then build out your program to support them in those roles. Okay, much larger discussion, but I wanted to be sure that we talked about the fact that there truly are no pure plays anymore right as we go into the business model discussion, because now we're going to go ahead and dissect this pie chart, and I just wanted to be sure that that disclaimer was out there up front. So that said, let's take a look at this pie chart. As I mentioned earlier, the pie chart represents roughly 150 to 160,000 solution providers across the U.S., and you see that the blue piece, or the VAR, which is now called the solution provider piece, is the largest piece of the pie, roughly representing 33%. And I'm just going to tell you, over time, that piece of the pie has been shrinking, and we have seen partners move out of that VAR business model into managed services or into systems integrator and other type business models. So what's interesting is, as that piece has shrunk, we've seen the managed service provider piece of the pie grow dramatically. I'd say about 8 years ago, the first time that we measured and put together and published this pie, that was 8% of the partner population fit in the managed services piece of the pie, roughly 8%. The next time we did it, it was about 12%. And we tend to refresh this data every 1 to 2 years, but you can see that from 8% to 23%, the managed service provider piece has typically been the fastest growing piece of this whole pie as VARs have moved to both managed service providers as well as systems integrators. And I'm going to go through the definitions for each one of these before we go, but you can see that the four largest business models or most prevalent business models tend to be reseller, meaning VAR, managed service provider, consultant at 15, systems integrator at 12. And then after that, it drops off fairly dramatically. And I just want to highlight a couple of the small and or new ones as we go through the definitions. You see here cloud broker, and we'll talk a little bit about the concept of a cloud broker around programs like Salesforce.com, you know, Google, Amazon Web Services, keep going, any public cloud service. We'll talk about the fact that once a customer gets to about 4 public cloud services, he tends to use a cloud broker to help him manage those services. New, showing up in the piece of the pie at 1%, digital marketing agencies, especially as we look at the Internet of Things and how marketing has in fact changed. Another smaller group, still growing, it used to be 1 and 2%, and going to 3% would be our carrier agents. These are partners who come from the telephony side of the house. So we'll talk about these, but just to highlight prevalent business models and then, you know, business models who are a little bit not as common as the others. So what I'm going to do is walk you through these definitions so you have them. This is very much less a presentation, much more walking you through a reference document. But the very first thing I want to tell you is that when we publish this research, like the pie chart on the previous page, that comes straight from our partners who complete our research. And what we don't do is ask them what they are. We don't ask them, are you a systems integrator? Are you a consultant? Are you a managed service provider? And the reason we don't ask is because oftentimes they get confused with the brand or what they're trying to put forward from a marketing perspective. What we do ask them is, tell us in which of these business models or roles you recognize revenue. So the final arbitration point for us is not how they see themselves or what they put on their website. It's how they recognize revenue, meaning what do they do to recognize revenue? So you see the first definition, solution provider VAR, if 50% or more of their company's revenues come from reselling hardware, software, and services, and those could be cloud services or not, and they take title and resell the product, then we would say, yes, their primary business model is a VAR. And then we would go ahead and ask for their secondary business model as well. The same is true from a consulting perspective. If 90% or more of their company revenues come from pre-sale and post-sale business process, strategy, IT, or design consulting, then they fall into the consultant bucket. And we see this especially happens if you look down here with born in the cloud type partners who came and grew up around Google or Amazon Web Services or Salesforce.com. Salesforce is a perfect example where they have a large ecosystem of consultants because they don't make their service available for resale. As a result, consulting tends to be the primary business model. Okay, so comparing and contrasting. Let's take a look then also at ISVs. If 85% or more of their company revenues come from developing an application that's commercially available, meaning it is made to be sold, right, to business customers, and it doesn't matter whether it's Windows, Unix, Linux, or Mac, but if it is commercially available, then they tend to be an ISV. And we will compare and contrast this a little bit later with a firm that does development or developers. Okay, let's keep going and take a look at DMRs or direct marketing resellers, people like CDW or Zones or the rest of these. If 80% or more of their revenues come from reselling hardware, software, and other support contracts, and maybe 20% or less are coming from professional or managed services, they would tend to, in fact, be a DMR. And you notice it's 80%, where VAR was about 50%. And that's how we separate somebody who's reselling from a VAR perspective from somebody like CDW or Zones, where it's the majority of what they do. A systems integrator would then be roughly 70% of their revenue from pre- and post-sales consulting, integration, and implementation, and then they have 30% of their revenue that can come from complementary skills. Those complementary skills could be reselling product, it could be managing services. The core of what they do, however, is pre-sale and post-sale consulting. And that consulting could come from an IT perspective. It could come from a telephony perspective around voice, data, and internet. It could also come from an operational perspective like Bosch, Siemens, GE Digital, any of the operational things that really support IoT as well. Okay? So they only take title and resell product or offer managed services as a secondary business model. It's not their primary. Their primary is pre- and post-sales consulting. And then custom systems builders. In this case, 50% or more of their revenues would come from designing and building and delivering their own brand of hardware. And in the old days, these used to be our white box type partners. But if you take a look at it today, white box isn't just about let me go buy the chips and all the pieces from Ingram and I'll put together a cheaper, better, faster machine or server than Dell can. It's really not about that. This is really about specialty type equipment, meaning gaming servers, healthcare servers that runs medical equipment. There's reasons why in different industries, custom systems builders put together custom boxes. Like in the manufacturing space, they tend to be a little bit hardened and they have to, you know, live through things like humidity and other type environments. So you do see that there are specialty boxes that are built, and that's a custom systems builder. Let's keep going with a managed service provider. A managed service provider's company revenues, 50% or more, would come from delivering managed services on a service level agreement, typically IT, and it could be data center. It could be desktop applications that they manage, security, VoIP, print. It's really almost anything, communications, that can be managed from an IT perspective. And then you might ask, well, how is a managed service provider different from a hosting services provider? And again, you see not only a difference in the level of revenue, and 85% or more of the revenue comes from the managed offerings, or in this case, the hosted offerings. But also I would ask you to take a look at the offerings. They're a little bit different. In this case, it's shared or dedicated or virtual private server hosting. And you get things like managed servers, dedicated servers, virtualization, clouds, colo, mobile applications. It could be email hosting. So this is where your Rackspaces and Amazon Web Services and others, application hosting. If you take a look at Amazon Web Services and Rackspace, they're huge hosters for ISVs who need to deliver software as a service and choose not to host it themselves, okay? So, for example, Microsoft is not only an ISV, but they're also a hosting service provider because Microsoft owns the applications and then they host the applications in their own data center where somebody like Cerner or McKesson. Cerner might own the hospital application, but rather than build its own data centers, they can go to Amazon Web Services and actually host it there for their software as a service offering. Okay, so those are hosting service providers. I mentioned earlier these ISVs that were developing commercially available applications and how they're different from application developers. An application developer, 50% or more of their revenues come from custom development, not commercially available development, custom development. And it's not available on a commercial basis, meaning it's done for a corporate customer, and it's either on a Windows or Linux or iOS or Android or maybe even an IoT platform that could be an edge application all the way down to an on-prem or a cloud application. But these people typically look like consultants. But when 50% or more of their revenues come from custom development, we tend to put them in the application developer bucket. This is important because this group is growing, and it's growing in importance. It started growing because of mobile apps, and it's growing more because of IoT applications. But this is where you'll get a lot of people with DevOps skills, container skills, all of those different types of skills. We touched very briefly on Cloud Broker in terms of a very small percentage of the pie, 1%. And here you see these are companies where 50% or more of their revenues come from administering public cloud services for a customer. You may remember I mentioned when a customer gets to four or more public cloud services, he tends no longer to manage the additions, the deletions, the changes, the security, the license compliance, the portal access, the billing. He tends not to do that anymore. He'll tend to get somebody to act as a cloud broker for him and to take care of that for him. Now, in some cases, you'll see some partners who truly are cloud brokers, meaning the majority of their revenues, 80% of their revenues, come from this. But also remember, most VARs who offer managed services or who have VAR relationships, whether it's a public cloud being consumed by their end customer, they will offer these services. But if they're not big enough to be 50% of their overall revenues, it'll be up under the covers, and it could be a secondary or a tertiary business model. You just may not see it based on the small percentage of revenue they're collecting doing this. We talked a little bit about the telephony channel and service provider agents. These folks come in with 50% or more of their company revenues come from commissions that are paid for recommending carrier-based data access, digital cable, high-speed online, or digital phone services. So these are the agents of people like Verizon, AT&T, and CenturyLink. And then most of us know our IT distributors. These are two-tiered distributors like Ingram and Synnex and Arrow and others who basically make products available to downstream resellers, VARs, and integrators as required. And then I want to introduce a new group that it's pretty difficult right now for us to identify. We're starting to identify it in our research, and these are the OT distributors. These folks come from the operational technology side of the house that is part of IoT. Their vendors are people like Siemens and Bosch and GE Digital and Schneider Electric and Honeywell, and they typically buy from the vendors, and then they sell to downstream systems integrators or resellers. The difference is these OT distributors tend to be many more numerous than the ones on the IT side, meaning Schneider Electric could have an OT distributor in any major metropolitan area. Like they could have 20 across this country as opposed to one like Ingram or Synnex, you know, or Arrow. So they tend to have, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50. The numbers are much larger than the IT distributors in our space. Okay? So that was just a really quick overview of this pie chart of business models that comes from our 2018 census. It says, let us show you a snapshot of primary business models. And that's what this pie chart represents. Now, in order to give you the full view, there are two research pieces. It's either our 2018 census or our partner profitability study. Both of those studies, as you spend time with us over the year and we go through those in webinars, both of those studies will give you a much deeper view of not only the primary business model, but also the secondary business model in terms of data, going all the way back to the puzzle piece slide that we used to open this section up that said, remember, we'll show you what the characteristics are, but when you implement this, you must have the puzzle pieces to represent the mix of primary and secondary business models that most likely represents your overall partner ecosystem. Okay? So with that, let's go ahead now and take a look at how cloud and managed services have also added to this, you know, overall pie chart. And what you start to see here are just a couple of quotes from our research where partners, a $40 million MSP and VAR and a $220 million systems integrator and VAR tell you about cloud and managed services, right? That why managed services help partners build trust with their clients and why building recurring revenue is so important to many of our partners. Now, to open this section up, what I'd like to do is to look back a little bit. And I'm just going to tell you, when I started in the channel, there were two types of vendors, and they were the top two. There were IT hardware manufacturers, right, or OEMs, and these were people like IBM and Hewlett-Packard and Sun Microsystems, and I think those were probably the big ones. And then there were software publishers, and way back in my day when I started the business, there were probably three software publishers, Microsoft, IBM, and Lotus Development Corp. Lotus later became part of IBM. Today, the software publishing group is huge, right? Especially when you take a look at, you know, you can keep going with Microsoft and IBM and Oracle and SAP, and then by vertical, Cerner McKesson or retail. You know, you can just keep going. Every vertical has its own software players, and then IoT has its own, and cloud has its own, and security has its own. Every segment now has a tremendous amount of software publishers, so this has grown dramatically. In the last 10 years, I talked a little bit about the service providers, and the service providers tend to be cloud service providers. They could also be a carrier service provider, but this is where we have recurring revenue, right, in terms of what these service providers offer. So here's AWS, Microsoft Azure, Google, Rackspace, CenturyLink, keep going. There are all kinds of service providers who, you know, 15 years ago were not in those businesses and were not vendors that had a channel. And now the service providers are truly vendors with their own channel. And then to close out the IoT conversation, you would see some operational technology vendors as well. And these are Siemens and Bosch, GE, Schneider Electric, Honeywell, and others who have developed their own channel over time and who are also recruiting into our channel. So before we go into the whole conversation of cloud, it's just to say, hey, by the way, the days of hardware and software are long gone. It's really hardware, software, public cloud services, as well as operational technology vendors. So the first thing I want to do around cloud, at least, is to segment some of the vendors. And I want to start off with the application service providers. These are the people who offer software as a service, and they're the names you know, SAP, Microsoft, Oracle, Google. I mentioned earlier one vertical, healthcare, and here's two examples. Cerner and McKesson tend to be the largest hospital software as a service, or ISVs, publishing in the industry in the U.S. today. And then, of course, we couldn't have the conversation without offering Salesforce.com, which would be the original cloud service provider. Salesforce was the first company ever to offer its applications via the cloud as a service. And then, as we all know, everybody else followed. So segment number one would be an almost unlimited number of application service providers who fit into that segment. Segment number two would be platform as a service providers. So here's where more development is taking place. This is Microsoft Azure, Amazon Web Services. CenturyLink also has a development platform as a service. And this is what has taken the place of having a whole bunch of development servers that were underutilized on-premise at the customer. Now the customer no longer needs to pay for those servers to sit there unutilized so many hours a day. They just go and buy the development capacity that they need from one of these platform as a service providers, which brought their cost down fairly dramatically. And then the third category would be our telcos, our wireline and wireless carriers. So people like CenturyLink, who's a telephone company, bought Savvis, who is an infrastructure as a service provider. Verizon bought Terramark. And Spectrum, who today owns Navisite, didn't originally buy them. Spectrum just keeps buying other cable companies. But what you start to see here are three infrastructure as a service providers, Savvis, Terramark, and Navisite, who have been bought by telcos and cablecos. And that happened over the last 8 to 9 years as telcos and cablecos got into cloud services and bought these capabilities to make the services that they sell a little bit more stable and sticky so they weren't being swapped out every year. And those Savvis, Terramark, and Navisite were the original players in this infrastructure as a service provider, which today is housed by people like IBM, VMware, Amazon Web Services, Google, and folks like Rackspace. And so where you see Savvis, Terramark, and Navisite were the originals in infrastructure, IBM and VMware are like, let's say, the latecomers, meaning they moved into this space after Amazon, after Google, and after Rackspace. That said, that's just a little bit of segmentation, a little bit of the history, but most importantly, what matters is the fact that all of these service providers, public cloud service providers, are recruiting your VARs in your ecosystem. They're looking for PBX VARs, they're looking for IT solution providers, they're looking for telephony agents, and they are also now recruiting operational technology integrators and VARs. So just a little bit of an oversight in terms of what the service provider segmentation looks like. Now, it wouldn't be a complete conversation if we didn't talk about what's happened in this space. And if you go back to, 2011, when people like Verizon was purchasing Terramark and getting into this space, in about the 2015-16 timeframe, we started to see that the telcos and cablecos said, God, we're not so sure that we can compete in this space against people like Amazon and Microsoft and the big behemoths. And so there was a lot of discussion about whether the telcos and cablecos would get out of the cloud service provider space. And if you fast forward all the way to 2018, I would tell you that they haven't gotten out of the space. They've continued to leverage their data centers and continued, even like CenturyLink, to make additional acquisitions. CenturyLink acquired Level 3. Level 3 was the largest wholesale provider of telco and cable co type services, long distance internet and high speed lines. And those data centers have continued to support the cloud businesses of those telcos just around cloud. So just an update on that. We watch that every year to see if these folks will get out of the business, and they don't. Okay? So just a high level, that was just like a high level of what's happening with public cloud and how that actually plays in the channel, all of which ultimately matters when we take a look at partner profitability. So we're going to start on the third part of today's prerequisite, which is in fact profitability, which says let's take a look at these partners who are represented by this pie chart, and let's understand what they do to make money, and let's understand how they make money and what type of money. So if you take a look at this funnel represents three things that a partner typically could do. They can resell product, and if they did, they might earn somewhere between 10 and 40 points of margin. They could deliver project-based services. These are services with a beginning and an end date. They tend to be one-time charge-based project services or time and material. And they could earn gross margins of somewhere between 28 to 45% on those services. Or they could deliver managed services on a service-level agreement contract. And for most managed services, they could earn somewhere between 35 and 47%, but we've seen some go as high as 75%. Really depends on the service and how much infrastructure they own. So let's take a look a little bit further about what they do to make money. And we'll start just with a conversation about what partners kind of care about. And if you're looking at a solution provider, somebody who might have been a VAR in the past, they care about adding the services revenue. They care about the solutions you ask them to sell and whether the products actually work. They care about what margin you offer them, whether there's rebates. And those are fairly traditional things that a partner might care about. But that's very different for those of you who have alliance agreements, let's say, with your service providers, who care about things like operational efficiencies, delivering on their service level agreement, and ensuring that they bring their operational expense down. And if you have partners who are managed service provider and who are operating their own data centers or operating their own networks or managing desktops, things like that, they care about these things as well. So you can see what somebody who's reselling product cares about is fairly different from somebody who's managing a service, okay? And that's why we take a look at why different tracks and partner programs matter. OEMs, let's say you have OEMs in your overall ecosystem because maybe you're in the Intel channel and you have people who are building stuff. OEMs are trying to decide, do I build versus buy? How long will it take me to take this to market? You know, can I grow my customer base? And again, that's different for those of you also who have distributors in your space who are looking for operational efficiencies because they're operating on, 1 to 5% margins. They look at ROI on you as a vendor. We all know they rank your products daily, rank your products weekly in terms of revenue and velocity, and they take a look at their contracts with you to see through the combination of margin and rebates and other programs, whether they can really make money on your line. They'll also look at the size of the market, meaning the addressable market opportunity. So we put this up here just to start out that says, if we're building programs and it doesn't have tracks to support the different things that different business models and different partners care about, you know, our programs tend to be less effective and efficient. And the more they reflect and can support the roles that your partner plays, the more effective and efficient your programs tend to be. So I'm going to start now with a typical solution provider who could have been a VAR, maybe a managed service provider, you know, could be an ISV, whatever the case might be. Let's take a look at what they do, back to that funnel in terms of making money. And we would tend to break down their capabilities into pre-sale capabilities, sales capabilities, meaning transacting capabilities, or and post-sale capabilities. And if you take a look at pre-sale, we'd start with the fact that they listen to the customer, design a solution to a business problem, and then architect the technology that will make that solution work. And those tend to be their pre-sales consulting or design services. When that's done, they can actually transact on a piece of hardware or software or maybe even a service. They can configure it, price it, deliver it. And when that piece of the transaction is complete, there is post-sale implementation, maintaining it, and managing it. And that tends to be the profile of a partner. Some partners are very good at selling with post-sale. Some partners are really good at pre-sale, and they don't sell at all. So it's very important in these three boxes to understand what your partners do and where their strengths are. I'm going to tell you, as a former channel chief, I put a lot more of my investment in partners who had pre-sale capabilities and could sell, and I had some really strong post-sale partners who really couldn't do the pre-sale work and really weren't interested in selling. And, you know, you can team them up or whatever the case might be, but it was my pre-sale partners that helped me build a pipeline, and I never forgot that. So understanding what they do ultimately dictates what types of margins they make on the different roles that they'll play. So let's take a look at any typical partner in terms of how he puts his business together, because we're going to now move to the discussion of how does he make money and how does he hear you ultimately. And when a partner puts his business plan together, he looks at his target audience, he looks at the value prop, meaning what does he offer to his customer, and then how will he offer it, meaning what business operation. The target audience means who they sell to. Are they selling to enterprise, mid-market, SMB? Are they selling only to the retail vertical or to the financial services vertical? The value proposition says, well, what are they selling? Are they selling services? Are they selling managed services? Are they selling consulting? What are they selling? And the business operation says, how do they do it? Do they do it on-prem? Do they do it remotely? Whatever the case might be. So part number one of a business plan of any of your partners is, let's put this business in place, and then we'll support it with what we call the financial layer. The financial layer tends to be the same no matter what type of partner, and that's because it's a typical accounting profit and loss statement, a P&L. And for those of you who went to business school, it's revenue minus cost of goods sold equals gross margin. And if you take your gross margins and subtract out your selling, general, and administrative costs, at a simple level, you get your operating income. And that P&L is in the head of every single partner we do business with. This is how they think. Partners, before they think of the overall P&L, when we talk to them, they think gross margin. They're listening to you to think, what kind of gross margins can I make off what you're asking me to do? They think of gross margin percents, and then ultimately they think in terms of gross margin dollars. They then understand their own selling, general, administrative expense, which helps them think of their operating or net income over time. And that's how it goes. Revenue is what you offer in terms of product resale, maintenance resale, services that they can deliver on their own. The cost of goods sold is subtracting out the cost for the product that you sold them at a discount, or the cost to pay the employees who deliver their services. The gross margin is what tends to be left, and it could be anywhere from, you know, 5 points to 40 points. As I said, in some cases, it could be as high as 70, just kind of depends. From there, they pay their sales reps, their managers, their staff, their rent, the copy machine, their insurance, the coffee, everything that comes out of their SG&A, and then what they're left with is the operating income, okay? And they probably set goals in terms of how to achieve an operating income percent. So that's the basic P&L. Now, one thing I'll mention is that we have channel managers throughout the industry that will typically talk to partners and say, hey, by the way, I'd really like you to invest and come into my partner program and sell my product, and we'll give you 20 points. So we talk about sell my product to generate revenue, and I'll give you 20 points. We go right to gross margin. And that's the conversation we have. Typically, I would tell you that in introducing a product or a maintenance or some service to be sold for 20 points or 30 points or 10 points, that's a fairly simplistic conversation. And it really causes the partner to have to fill in the rest of the pieces because we're not talking to him in the way he thinks. So what we would like to introduce is this concept, not necessarily for you because you aren't CAMs, but we definitely do this for our CAMs, but we'd like you to think about it from a building a partner program perspective, is what can you do through your program to help the partner increase their revenue, decrease their cost of goods sold, increase their gross margins, decrease their selling, general, and administrative expenses, so that at the end of the day, the partner makes more net income because he entered into a business relationship with you. That's how we would ask you to think about your partner programs. Okay? So basically, in our CAM training, this is basically what we teach. We teach CAMs, channel account managers, how to come in and talk to partners about the revenue. What's the mix of hardware, software, and services that that partner is going to deliver for the year? What types of controls do they have in place to decrease their cost of goods sold? To understand what program offerings you have that can decrease their cost of goods sold, like education. Education might decrease either cost of goods sold or selling and general administrative expense. It depends on how the partner does their accounting. But anytime you bring MDF, right, that would decrease SG&A. Anytime you bring in education, it might decrease the cost of goods sold on service delivery costs. So what you start to get is a business conversation around how you're managing or how they are managing their business and what you can bring from a program perspective to help increase revenue, decrease cost of goods sold, that increases their gross margins, and then ultimately offerings to decrease their SG&A. And our belief is if you can have that kind of conversation, if your program supports that type of contribution, you have a much better chance of having a loyal, long-standing, revenue-generating partner. So with that, let's take a look at this P&L, and let's break down the pieces. If we looked at revenue, this is where all your hardware, software, technical services sales, professional services, managed services, consulting services, any warranty or maintenance, resale services, any incentives, programs, rebates, and sometimes rebates go right to the bottom line. They go right to profit. Sometimes rebates come back here to revenue. It depends on the accounting treatment. But this would give you a pretty good idea of what's in the revenue bucket. One of the things that we typically watch for partners is how often they're transacting, right, their quantity. What's the typical transaction size? Are they transacting at the average size or are they transacting larger than the typical partner? And are what's their velocity? Are they transacting, you know, every week, every month, every day, or are they waiting till fourth quarter and they transact everything at the end of the quarter? From a cost of goods sold, we're looking to decrease these. So we're looking to decrease hardware and software product costs they buy from you. The greater your discount, the more cost of goods sold goes down. Delivery personnel, time and material costs, any data center they're operating, any NOC that they operate when they're MSPs, anytime they develop intellectual property, things like checklists and implementation routines, security audits, all of that is intellectual property that they tend to develop. Anytime you give them intellectual property or assets because you already have a statement of work that would go with implementing this product and you can give it to them that they can use 87% of that, you have decreased their cost of goods sold. Anytime you give them mentoring, you know, with the customer or anything that helps them with technical training, that decreases their skills development costs, that decreases their cost of goods sold. So again, think of your program benefits and what you can do to help decrease cost of goods sold. One of the things that you all do very well to decrease SG&A is offer MDF. If you take a look at SG&A, this is salaries, commissions, operating tools, marketing costs. So anytime a partner spends 8% of his revenue on marketing, that tends to be about best of breed. When you give them MDF, that decreases their spend and therefore decreases SG&A, which ups their operating income. So just to kind of give you a view, and remember, out of SG&A, they also pay their rent, utilities, but also if you ask them to have demo equipment and they have to buy that demo equipment, that increases their SG&A. If you give them loan or demo equipment, that decreases their SG&A. So understanding how program benefits impact different parts of the P&L is what we're about. Financing, we tend not to touch unless you're Cisco, IBM. These are two companies, and there's a handful of companies who have offered their own financing. This type of financing has helped many partners move from the VAR business model to the managed services offerings by not necessarily asking for a one-time charge payment, let's say, for a managed service type tool. So also in your financing, it might be pricing. Sometimes pricing really makes a difference if you price some of your stuff on recurring revenue. But other than that, we tend not to get involved in line of credit, receivables, bad debt. Your line of credit or the partner line of credit typically comes from their distributor, or it could come from you if you don't have distribution. You are, in fact, offering line of credit, and then you do have a big part in this financing box. But most of us don't have direct relationships with our partners unless there are DMRs or our distributors. Okay, so there's your very simple P&L view, and this is a true accounting one with, you know, revenue, total operating expense, and then your EBITDA, and then taking out depreciation, interest, and taxes. And just remember that our job is to think of what we can do to decrease costs or increase things like revenue. So those were the three main things we wanted to talk about in terms of getting everybody on the same page in terms of terminology around partner business models that we looked at in this pie chart. We also introduced a little bit of the impact of cloud and managed services and very much public cloud service providers, who they are, the fact that they're recruiting in your space, and the fact that if you're listening to this as a public cloud service provider, you're here to understand how to build programs because you're recruiting these partners. And then lastly, we just introduced a standard P&L and gave you some ideas of how that P&L can, in fact, tied to your partner program. So with that, I want to thank you for taking the time to join us today. Thank you for investing in Channel Masters before you get into the room. And we look forward to meeting you all in person and spending the next 12 months with you. Thanks again and take care.